You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, while the Mueller investigation wrapped up last week, it wasn't the only legal challenge facing President Trump or his family. We'll learn more about the investigations that are still ongoing. Now, TV shows and movies are full of portrayals of jury trials. Whether it's a panel of citizens listening to compelling evidence presented by attorneys and witnesses, or thoughtful, sometimes heated deliberations taking place as members of the jury argue for what they feel is the most just and appropriate verdict, we probably all have an image in our heads. But our next guest says that the constitutional right to be judged by a panel of your peers is in danger of disappearing, and that fewer and fewer cases are going to trial, let alone before a jury. Drury Sherrod, Ph.D., is the co-founder of Mattson and Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategy and jury selection. He's a member of the American Society of Trial Consultants, the American Psychological Association, and the Society for Experimental Social Psychology. A prolific author, his latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Drury, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Where does the right to be tried by a jury of our peers come from?
It comes from the Magna Carta originally. It originated in little Anglo-Saxon villages about 900 years ago. And then over the years, it was brought to America of the colonies and then as part of the United States Constitution. So the Sixth and Seventh Amendment in the Constitution guarantee the right to trial by jury. One pertains to criminal trials, one pertains to civil trials.
And so we're talking a millennium ago in England. What did it look like then to be tried by a jury of your peers?
Fairly different from what we know as a jury trial today. Originally, there was the king's officer would ride into town, assemble a group of local men. They were always men. They were of similar status. And then they would. There were no evidence. There were no witnesses. There were no cross-examinations or examinations. These local villagers would simply discuss together what they had heard about the person. Take a typical Anglo-Saxon name, Godric. They would talk about old Godric, and they would say, well, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would do this. Or somebody else would say, he's starting to change, I've heard. So they would talk for about an hour or so and then reach a verdict. And for many centuries, that was the nature of trial by jury. It was called self-informing jurors, that they didn't listen to evidence. They just judged based on what they knew about the alleged the person who was accused of a problem.
And then bringing it up to today in the United States, who do we think of as a peer for someone who has been charged with a crime?
It's a huge problem. The courts have over and over defined it, said that what we have in the U.S. is a jury of one's peers. But it's very hard to know what is a peer. There's lots of problems. One is that most people who, 15% of people never receive a jury summons because they've changed address or haven't left a new address or something like that. Another, about 12% receives a summons and ignores it. That you already take about a quarter or a third off the sample. And then when people come to trial, jury selections are, you know, often people get excuses pretty easily, especially in state courts where judges are elected, so judges don't want to be unpopular. There are lots of strikes. Attorneys can strike a juror for cause if the juror admits that they're too biased to be on the trial. Also, jurors are struck with peremptory strikes when an attorney just would say, I don't like the way that person is looking at me.
Hmm. You write that fewer and fewer cases are going to trial at all. Why would that be?
Well, that is the crisis, the jury crisis today. The exact figures are about, this is amazing, one half of 1% of all the civil trials that ever are filed in a year ever see a jury. That's one half of 1%. That's down from about 20 to 25% in the 1980s. And if you look at criminal trials, it's less than 1% of all criminal trials filed in a year ever see a jury. So that's been referred to, I think you used the phrase, the death of trial by jury, or the vanishing jury, or the disappearing jury.
And why is that? Why would that change so much in a relatively short amount of time?
Partly is that jurors have developed a bad reputation. Jurors are demeaned, dismissed, denigrated, their verdicts ridiculed. Now, invariably, whenever I work with attorneys on jury trials, someone mentions the McDonald's coffee case, which was widely seen as a nutty verdict, that a lady who spilled coffee was awarded $2.7 million in damages. there's lots more to the story that makes it somewhat more plausible. But one of the big reasons is that jurors, there are all these high-profile celebrity trials. For example, in the first Bill Cosby case where he was tried for sexual assault, juries deliberated for 52 hours, which is longer than even the length of the evidence. And they spent a whole day, they said, when they were interviewed afterwards by reporters, they spent a whole day debating the meaning of reckless and finally sent a note to the judge to define reckless. And the judge wrote back that they had to use their own common sense understanding of what it meant. So jurors are mistrusted. Jurors often don't seem to be able to perform what's required of them in terms of understanding evidence, arriving at a reasonable verdict, engaging in deliberations that are expected as deliberations.
So does that mean that lawyers are then counseling their clients to, for instance, take a plea or opt for a bench trial or somehow trying to avoid actually having their case go in front of a jury?
That's exactly what's happening. In criminal trials, plea bargaining has replaced trial by jury. In civil trials, that's when corporations sue each other or a person sues a corporation. In civil trials, they either settle or it goes into what's called ADR, alternative dispute resolution, which is where the case is turned over to mediators or arbitrators. And I bet in almost any contract you've signed, or whenever you're on the web and you click that little box that says agree to terms, you're agreeing to waive your right to trial by jury if you have a dispute with a product you ordered, or say if the cell phone contracts are notorious. I looked at my cell phone contracts and noticed that in three different places, in large, black, oversized type, it requires you to waive your right to trial by jury and agree to binding arbitration.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He is an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and his latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we did ask our listeners, Drury, on Facebook to tell us about their experiences of being on juries. Paul on Facebook said, seems to work just fine in my county, and he said it's Racine County here in Wisconsin. Dave on Facebook said, I was the foreman on a jury for a civil case. I thought the system worked well. We shared our views and came up with what we felt was a just verdict. And so it's interesting because granted, it's just two anecdotal comments, but there's the perception, like you said, of, you know, for instance, that McDonald's coffee, a hot coffee case, there's a perception of maybe a system that's gone off the rails, but then some people who are actually involved in jury deliberations say, yeah, actually, you know, it worked pretty well.
I think actually when people tell me what can they do to get off a jury trial, I tell them you really should be on the jury. And often people find it ennobling. It really, it's a moral experience for them. And they learn to sit down and deliberate with people they would never probably come across and talk to in real life. But I think it works as, if we didn't have juries, it would be bad for democracy. Trial by jury is a stepping stone on the whole goal of a democratic culture, I think.
You come at jury selection and trial strategy from a psychological perspective, and you say that the ways trials are run, how evidence is presented, and what we ask of members of a jury really runs counter to how our human minds work. How is that? What's the mismatch there?
There's so much research on how jurors actually make decisions, and it's generally called the story model of jury decision-making. And through lots of experimental research, they find actually when jurors first start hearing about a case, they begin telling a story. Like the way people understand what happened in a case is to match it to a similar event in their own life. And so very early in any kind of case, the jurors will start telling a story. And surprisingly, about two-thirds of jurors in most cases have decided how to vote on the verdict during the opening statement before they've heard any evidence at all. And partly this is because a lot of psychologists, including Daniel Kahneman, who's the founder of behavioral economics, a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, economist, he said that the brain evolved to jump to conclusions based on narratives that we draw from our own lives, not on methodical analytic evaluation of evidence. So we have this built-in bias to jump to a conclusion. We jump to that conclusion early in the opening statement, and then that influences what we attend to during the cases in chief and how we recall it. And when we sit down to deliberate, it influences the stories we tell to our fellow jurors.
And I'm guessing then, as we hear different testimonies or items of evidence, and whether it's coming from the prosecution or the defense, if if completely unconsciously we've already started making a decision, the things that agree with us are the things that stick. That confirmation bias comes through.
That's partly because we actually see different worlds without even realizing it. We did a nice study in my jury research firm. We had done lots of auto defect allegation cases. So we ran a huge study with about 5,000 subjects to see how plaintiff jurors in an auto defect case differ from defense jurors. And plaintiff jurors actually saw different worlds. They had more experience with accidents or injuries. They feared injury. They doubted they could protect themselves from injuries. They evaluated risk and harm differently. So you can see how in a case where jurors had to decide if an automobile was defectively designed or not, if they start off appraising the nature of risk and the nature of danger and the nature of harm and hazard entirely differently, they're going to have a hard time sitting down to deliberate.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He's an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and his new book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever served on a jury? What was that experience like? How hard was it to sort through the information you were given and to understand the legal aspects of the case? Did you feel good about the verdict that was returned? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. We're picking up our conversation with trial strategy and jury selection expert Drury Sherrod. His new book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you were on trial, would you rather have a jury or a judge decide your fate? If you served on a jury, what was the experience like, and was it what you expected it to be? For better or worse, do you feel like you have a more realistic idea of how our justice system works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Drury, you talked about how jurors process information as stories, not just as facts that they accumulate, and then at the end they make your decision. What about the issue of having to understand some fairly arcane legal points, as you were saying, the jurors in the first Bill Cosby trial? How does that play into this?
I think the important thing about stories that I would like to make sure that it's clear is that if attorneys see a jury trial as a contest between stories, not as a contest between evidence, but as a contest between stories, then it's incumbent on the attorneys to organize the evidence into stories. And the story model of jury research shows that jurors are much more persuaded by a narrative organization of evidence than a chronological. Typically, what most attorneys will do is have a yellow pad, maybe 50 points, they just check off each one, and they'll say, this witness will testify about this point, another witness will testify about this point. Then as the witnesses are called, they appear out of order, more or less when it's convenient for them to fly in. It's very hard for the juror's brain to assemble all that information. So one of my main recommendations in the book is for attorneys to think like jurors, to think like storytellers, rather than like law school professors who are presenting evidence.
And you said that a large proportion of jurors actually begin or even complete making their decision during the opening statements. And it seems to me like the opening statements and probably the closing statements are the most narrative parts of the trial.
Actually, there are three opportunities. There's the pre-voir dire overview, when the attorney gets to explain to jurors something about what the case is about. So when they're questioned during voir dire, they'll be able to say something like, that happened to me, and I'm already biased in this case. I can't be a good juror. The other place is the opening statements, and that's where the jurors begin to make up their minds, two-thirds to three-quarters before the evidence. And then the final, you would think, closing arguments would be another time to try to persuade jurors. But by then, jurors have firmly made up their minds. Closing arguments don't do much to change their minds. What at the closing argument should be used to retell the story and point out how each of the witnesses fits into the total story.
Brandy on Facebook said she was called for jury duty twice in 2 months, never before, never since. And she says, I think the main challenge is for jurors to understand the law and the concept of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that something that you see emerging as you look at many different cases and how they turn out?
The word reasonable is one of those very interesting terms that different people perceive differently. Now, what's reasonable to one person is not reasonable to another. Or what is harmful or hazardous to one is not harmful or hazardous to another. It's that example I gave about people who tend to identify with plaintiffs in auto trials are much more likely to think, you know, the world is just full of huge hazards out there. I have to be aware of all these hazards, and I ought to be very clearly warned about them and very clearly informed how to avoid them. And if they think that a product or a vehicle or something the manufacturer hasn't adequately warned or instructed on how to avoid, then they're going to think, this is unreasonably dangerous. So it's really interesting. You know, this point I've made is that different types of people perceive different worlds, so they tell different stories about what's going on. And that's why I think the attorneys have to think like a juror instead of like a judge. And also, I think you asked about judges' instructions. There's so much evidence that judges' instructions just go over jurors' heads. Mm-hmm. The recent El Chapo trial, I think the judge gave, I read this, 3 hours of instructions. And jurors had to decide on 54 different verdict questions. And it took them, I think, 7 days to do that. But lots of research suggests that judges' instructions would be better understood if they were put at the beginning of a trial instead of at the end of all the evidence. Because it's when you think about it, the instructions are to really telling a jury, like, this is what you have to find to prove guilt or innocence. And so they should know that at the outset, because that would help them decide what to attend to, instead of after weeks of evidence and hearing, let's say, an hour of judges' instructions, and finally thinking, oh, I think I see what I'm supposed to have done.
Hmm. We're talking with Drury Sherrod about his new book, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And let's go to the phones, and Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I was on a very interesting trial one time. A man and a woman had been living together but not married for close to 30 years. The man died and left a will giving to the woman a valuable violin, a sum of money, and many personal effects. But he reserved the majority of his worldly goods to his brothers and sisters. Well, the woman pressed a suit claiming that she had loved him, cooked for him, cleaned for him, and took care of him in his final illness for 30 years, and therefore she should be entitled to his property as a common law wife. Well, we went to deliberate eventually, and a very high-powered type A personality man, obviously an executive of some kind, took charge of the jury and really manipulated the whole thing. It was very obvious he was eager to get out of there. It turned out that that because this man had left a will, clearly elucidating in the will what he wanted his lover to have, that was paramount, and therefore the woman would only get those things, and therefore she lost her suit. Now, every other woman in the room voted that she should get half the property. I was the only woman who voted with this high-powered type man because I truly did feel that he had clearly pointed out what he wanted her to have. So when we left that room, every other woman was extremely angry with me and talked to me very harshly.
And I'm going to leave it there, Nancy, because we're getting a little short on time. Thank you for giving us that insight into your experience. James on Facebook says he served on a jury for a civil case involving the family of a child and an insurance company fighting over money paid out for a dog bite. He says, I had a feeling some of the jurors on the side that eventually found for the insurance company were letting their own personal political beliefs get in the way of the facts. I probably should have told the judge, but for some reason, I didn't. And Drury, it's interesting because it's clear from our caller and from our Facebook commenter that, you know, we're not going in there as blank slates. We are going into a deliberation with a whole set of experiences and perspectives.
No, using this story model, the fact is it influenced the stories that we tell are called stored scripts. They're scripts about similar events from our own lives. So as soon as we start hearing of the case, as I said earlier, that's when we start thinking, well, yeah, you know, if this was a dog bite case, you know, I had a similar dog bite case, and my neighbor told me about a dog. And so they start telling us. Then what's really interesting is in deliberations, almost half of what jurors say was never mentioned in court. It's just anecdotes from their own lives that help support the verdict they reached.
Drury, I'm curious, if you were charged with a crime and had the choice, would you go before a jury or would you opt for a bench trial?
No, I would go before a jury. I mean, first, the reason is that it's an error to see judges or arbitrators or mediators as free of bias. They are just as biased because they have the same brains that jurors do. They also resort to stories. They just may resort to different types of stories, but they're not bias-free. And if you accept that they're not bias-free, then I think it's much better to spread the bias across 6 to 12 people who you would find on a jury instead of vesting it in one expert, one arbitrator, or one judge. And additionally, we've done, when in my jury research firm, when we were preparing attorneys for bench trials, we would hire panels of retired judges, and they would get dense packets of information, they would listen to the case, they would deliberate, and then they would reach verdicts in questionnaires. And analyzing the questionnaires showed that judges would split among themselves about which side was right or wrong. And when they did decide to jointly that one side was right, they would have different reasons for deciding it. So judges are just as biased as humans and arrive at just as diverse reasons and decisions, and probably from their own lives.
Well, Drury, thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Drury Sherrod is the co-founder of Mattson & Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategies and jury selection. His latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And you can continue the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you served on a jury? What was that like? How did you feel that you were making your decision? Was it, as Drury said, based on the story that made sense to you, or was it trying to put together a large mass of facts that may or may not be connected in a narrative? Share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, the Mueller probe concluded last week, but there are other investigations into the business dealings of President Trump and his family. We'll learn more after the news. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 7:30 on The Morning Show, decluttering is a popular pursuit. Host John Munson and his guests discuss how tackling clutter around us can lead to more inner calm. That's tomorrow morning after 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for nearly 2 years, the Mueller investigation captivated the public's attention. And depending on one's political views, the investigation was either viewed with hope or derision. While the report hasn't been released publicly, this is what we do know from Attorney General William Barr. The probe did not find collusion between the president and Russia, but it did not fully exonerate President Trump on obstruction of justice charges tied to the 2017 firing of then FBI Director James Comey. While President Trump and the White House declared victory this week, there are still a number of investigations into potential wrongdoing by the president and his family, ranging from top security clearances for his son-in-law and dealings by his foundation. Our next guest joins us to talk about the ongoing legal issues facing the Trumps and the tone it could set for the rest of President Trump's first term. Juliet Sorensen is a clinical professor of law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law and the director of the Bloom Legal Clinic. Juliet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
First, Robert Mueller concluded his investigation and submitted his report to the Department of Justice. It's been a fixture of media coverage since 2017. What was your takeaway from the last couple of days?
My takeaway is that a four-page summary is inadequate as a means to communicate the thrust of a vast two-year investigation. I hope that the four-page summary is merely an introduction and that both the public and Congress get much more by way of substance from Attorney General Barr in the near future.
Has the Attorney General given any indications that he is planning to either release a redacted full report or in some way provide more information?
Yes, he has. He stated in the summary that he would be working with the special counsel to essentially cull from the report what is information that is either classified or otherwise protected by grand jury secrecy rules, which is to say obtained pursuant to a grand jury subpoena. That information cannot be shared because of those rules. However, information obtained pursuant to ordinary interviews, conversations, records turned over voluntarily, not pursuant to a subpoena, all of that can be shared. And also what can be shared is the legal analysis of the special counsel, which is important.
As we mentioned just a moment ago, outside of the Mueller investigation and what we may or may not find out more about, the president and his family have faced a number of other legal challenges in different venues, one being a probe by the Southern District of New York into nearly $300,000 in hush money paid to two women, nearly half from the parent company of the National Enquirer, and the rest by the president's former attorney, Michael Cohen. Prosecutors say this violated campaign finance law. Can you break down why that is, why that might be a potential violation?
Certainly. So the hush money case stems from Michael Cohen working with the National Enquirer to play a game of what's known as catch and kill, which is to pay these two women for their stories so that the Enquirer would have exclusive rights to publish those stories and then not publish them at all. This becomes a campaign finance violation in the following way. If the purpose of the catch and kill is to influence the outcome of the election, which prosecutors allege that it was, then Michael Cohen paying money to that organization effectively counts as a campaign contribution, and it's a contribution far in excess of what is permitted by law.
And as I recall, for at least one of these payouts, the president reimbursed Cohen, is that correct?
That is what is alleged, yes.
And how does that fit in? Is that better or worse than what was being proposed initially?
Well, it is worse for the president in that it directly implicates him in a criminal case, and I would say not only criminal charges, but charges to which Michael Cohen, at least, has already pled guilty and been sentenced. That indictment states that Michael Cohen acted in the coordination and at the direction of Trump. And when Michael Cohen testified before Congress not long ago, he produced what appeared to be invoices showing that Donald Trump had, in fact, reimbursed Cohen for his paying the Enquirer. And so in that sense, it looks like Donald Trump has criminal exposure either as a co-conspirator in violating campaign finance laws or perhaps substantively violating the law itself.
As we said, this case is in the Southern District of New York. What is the next step in this investigation?
So as I said, Michael Cohen himself has pled guilty and been sentenced. The American Media Incorporated, which is the parent company of the National Enquirer, actually negotiated a non-prosecution agreement with federal prosecutors. That indicates that American Media Inc. is cooperating with federal prosecutors, and apparently there is an ongoing investigation still in the Southern District of New York into the campaign finance issues, including whether or not Trump and the Trump Organization played any role.
We're talking with Juliet Sorensen. She's a clinical professor of law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. And we are talking about the other investigations and court cases that involve President Trump and his family. And Juliet, you joined us last summer when the New York Attorney General filed charges against the Trump Foundation. They alleged that the family used the foundation for personal and political gain. Where are we at here about 9 months later?
So the investigation into the Trump Foundation is ongoing by the New York Attorney General for a few different topics. They sued the Trump Foundation last year. Their complaint stated that the Trump Foundation engaged in what they called a shocking pattern of illegality. The Trumps actually agreed to dissolve the foundation in December, but that doesn't get rid of the lawsuit, which is ongoing. The Attorney General wants the Trumps to pay millions in prison penalties. They also want to bar Donald Trump from serving on the board of any New York charity for a decade. New York charities are regulated by the New York Attorney General's office. And finally, the Trump Foundation is under a related investigation for potentially violating state tax laws. This could either be result in a civil or administrative case. It could also potentially result in a criminal tax fraud case.
There have been calls from Democrats in particular since the campaign, actually, before President Trump won office, calling for the release of his tax returns. He has refused. Is this lawsuit a potential avenue to gain access to that?
Well, this lawsuit, that is to say the lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General's office, is focused on taxes paid in the state of New York. Obviously, the Trump Organization is on the hook for both state and federal taxes. Whether or not there is a federal investigation, that is to say by the IRS criminal investigation section, into Trump's taxes and potential tax fraud, that we do not know.
We're talking right now with Juliet Sorensen. She's clinical professor of law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law and the director of the Bloom Legal Clinic. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the ongoing investigations? What would you like to see come out of these inquiries? Or are you ready for these probes to come to an end? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, the Mueller investigation is over, but there are other probes and lawsuits facing President Trump and his family. Our guest is Juliet Sorensen. She's a clinical professor of law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law and the director of the Bloom Legal Clinic. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What were your thoughts on the Mueller probe? What do you think about all of the legal challenges still facing the Trumps? Is there anything that you would like to see change in light of all these investigations? Or do you think that some of the allegations facing the president and his family are overblown? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Juliet, I want to talk about another case that I feel like has gotten maybe a little less attention in the media or in the public sphere, the investigation into the Trump Inaugural Committee. What are the important parts of that case?
So based on what we know, and I should caution that we know very little because this is an uncharged investigation, it appears that federal prosecutors in several different districts are looking into the money that Trump's inauguration committee raised, and specifically who the money came from, how it was spent, and whether or not donors were given favors or special access in exchange for donations to the inauguration committee.
And it seems like one of the issues there is whether there were foreign donors, that their donations were being kind of funneled through other channels. Why is that a big deal?
Yeah, that's correct. So as a matter of election and campaign finance law, candidates are not permitted to accept money from foreign donors. The converse is also true. U.S. individuals are not permitted to typically donate money to campaigns overseas. Now, Donald Trump, of course, was not a candidate at that time. He was the president-elect. Nonetheless, the rule still applies. And last September, a Republican political consultant admitted steering about $50,000 from a Ukrainian oligarch to the inauguration committee. It appears to be something that the special counsel's office also looked into, and now the U.S. attorney's offices in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
There are several congressional investigations going on, and one is looking at the top security clearances that were given to members of the president's family, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and where the impetus came from for giving them those top security clearances. What do we know about this so far?
That's right. That investigation is being conducted by the House Oversight Committee. It has focused on the Trump administration's handling of security clearances, particularly after reports surfaced that the president intervened to actually overrule a determination by intelligence officials and to demand security clearance for his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. This actually is not limited to Mr. Kushner. It seems that the White House overruled intelligence officials on at least 30 security clearances of White House staff members.
Is that unusual?
You know, the truth is, Judith, I can't speak to deep experience on the extent to which White House staff overrules advice from the intelligence community with regard to staff security clearances. It seems that it ought to be for a good reason, and that's what the House Oversight Committee is looking into. They've asked the White House for documents related to the security clearances, and they'd like to know why these concerns were being overruled.
Let's go to a caller now. Andrew in Waukesha is up. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, you know, I tell you what, I'm curious as to why this seems to be a scandal when Congress is doing its job. Congress is always supposed to be a check on the executive branch. And it seems to me it only happens when you have opposite parties in control of the presidency and Congress. I think this should be normal. I think America should get used to Congress holding the executive accountable for things that they do. During the Obama administration, Eric Holder was held in contempt of Congress for denying them access to documents and information. And, you know, it's going to be a tug of war. I think that's a good thing when you have equal branches of government keeping check on one another.
Thank you for the call, Andrew. And Juliet, what would you say to Andrew's point?
Andrew, I agree completely. It's an essential component of Congress that it has an oversight function as to the executive branch. It's exercising that oversight function in good faith, in ways that it deems appropriate, is not only proper, but as you say, it's essential to our system of separation of powers.
Thank you for that call, Andrew. And Juliet, so we've talked about several investigations. There are lawsuits against the president, against his close advisors and colleagues. There are also civil suits that are brought against the president. What do we know about those?
There are several civil suits as well. There is a lawsuit alleging that Donald Trump has violated the Emoluments Clause. This is a clause of the Constitution that is fairly rarely invoked, but it's important. It says that no federal official can accept any gift or benefit from any foreign government. The question is whether or not Trump and the Trump Organization has accepted gifts and benefits from foreign governments as they relate to Trump's business.
Juliet, there's so much to keep track of here, and they're all kind of on different timelines. What are you going to be watching for in the next few months?
Well, firstly and importantly, I'm going to be watching for how much information is released to the public from the special counsel's report. I think it's crucial that as much information as is permitted by law can be made public. Secondly, I believe that how much information is released to Congress, which could differ from how much is actually made public, is going to in turn inform what Congress decides to do, as your caller pointed out, exercising its oversight function, the direction it carries its own investigation. Will it have to start at square one, subpoenaing individuals who have already testified in the grand jury? Maybe so, but if what it learns from the special counsel is too important to ignore, it will carry that forward.
Well, Juliet, as we said, so much to keep track of. We really appreciate you helping us try to sort out all of the details and to look forward to what's coming next.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Juliet Sorensen is a clinical professor of law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law and the director of the Bloom Legal Clinic. She joined us today to talk about all of the legal challenges still facing President Trump, his foundation, and his family now that the Mueller probe has concluded. And you can keep the conversation going by sending your comments through Twitter. You can tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. dispute over the insurance carried by a Canadian energy firm was heard today by the state's highest court. This fight stems from one county's requirement that Enbridge obtain special pollution insurance as part of a plan to triple the amount of oil being sent through a pipeline running across Wisconsin. WPR's Danielle Kading has more.
A creek runs along the edge of Keith Riopel's property. He and his wife built their home in the small village of Marshall in Dane County about 8 years ago.
It's kind of like a little slice of heaven for us.
Here he can trade the bustle of Madison for the sounds of sandhill cranes and wood ducks. But Riopel says he didn't know when they moved in that an oil pipeline was running through the land nearby. Then energy firm Enbridge expanded the pipeline. Now Riopel, who heads Dane County's climate change efforts, and others are part of a lawsuit to keep a county permit requirement that Enbridge obtain insurance to cover cleanup costs of any potential spill.
Heaven forbid if there was ever a spill here, but if that does happen, you know, we want the company to be responsible, and we don't want to be the next Kalamazoo River situation here in our backyard.
Oil from an Enbridge pipeline spilled into Michigan's Kalamazoo River in 2010. The cleanup recovered more than 1 million gallons of oil and cost the company $1.2 billion. Dave Galt is Dane County Assistant Corporation Counsel.
Our zoning committee had some concern that Enbridge provide some assurance that they had the financial responsibility to completely remediate any potential catastrophic spill.
The county and landowners say that threat is growing as Enbridge expands the pipeline's capacity up to 1.2 million barrels per day. With scientists sounding the alarm on climate change, county officials also fear a transition to renewable energy could make a company that transports fossil fuels less financially stable. But in 2015, lawmakers slipped a last-minute measure into the budget to block Dane County's insurance requirement. It said if a pipeline operator already carries a policy that covers sudden and accidental pollution, counties couldn't require more. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said then that Republicans adopted the proposal because Dane County was holding up the project.
They're going to do it in a safe way, but we want to make sure that we have an opportunity for those jobs and the opportunity to get that project done.
Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith says the company believes the county's insurance requirements violate the law, and there's no guarantee they could get the kind of insurance the county wants.
But outside of that, they're really unnecessary. We do have the appropriate insurance, and we do have the resources and financial withstanding to respond in the rare event of a pipeline incident.
Enbridge challenged the additional insurance requirements in county court and won, but the county and landowners appealed. An appeals court panel ruled in their favor. The county and landowners worry Enbridge's policy doesn't cover everything. Insurance consultant David Dibdahl evaluated the company's coverage as part of Dane County's permitting process. He says the company's general liability policy limits coverage to damage or pollution that's reported within a certain time frame. And he says Enbridge only provided a summary of its insurance.
Which I took in faith because Enbridge is a big company and they hire professional risk managers and competent insurance brokers. If they represent they have coverage, they probably do as represented.
Dibdahl says the company claimed the insurance contained trade secrets, but he thinks that shouldn't prevent them from presenting the documents in court, and landowner Keith Riopel agrees.
If they have insurance that they think is adequate, you'd think the easiest way to convince people of that would be to, you know, take out the insurance policy and walk into the courts and say, here it is, look at it.
Enbridge argues the law doesn't require them to provide the policies. The company hopes the Supreme Court will allow their permit to stand without the insurance requirements. The county and Riopel hope they'll be able to use whatever means available to protect landowners from the risks of a potential spill. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our colleagues at WisContext took a look at historical redlining in Milwaukee and how it explains a lot about why Wisconsin's largest city is the most segregated in the United States. Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum has been spending a lot of time with high schoolers lately. She's been working with them on storytelling for radio, and we'll hear the first piece that one of them has produced for WPR. And we will talk about some of the state's best trunk highways to explore just in time for spring. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 7, host John Munson talks with Wisconsin Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman about the Mueller report findings, other investigations that are still pending in Congress and elsewhere, and how Congress and the nation can move forward. That's tomorrow morning after 7, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then it's an ode to the public library. We talk about what you love about libraries, books, and the community it builds. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.